these words from 2 Kings. When the Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven in a whirlwind, Elijah and Elisha were on their way from Gilgal. Elijah said to Elisha, "Stay here. The Lord has sent me to Bethel." But Elisha said, "As surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you." So they went down to Bethel. The company of the prophets at Bethel came out to Elisha and asked, "Do you know that the Lord is going to take your master from you today?" "Yes, I know," said Elisha. "So be quiet." Then Elijah said to him, "Stay here, Elisha. The Lord has sent me to Jericho." And he replied, "As surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you." So they went to Jericho. The company of the prophets at Jericho went up to Elisha and asked him, "Do you know that the Lord is going to take your master from you today?" "Yes, I know," he replied, "so be quiet." Then Elijah said to him, "Stay here. The Lord has sent me to the Jordan." And he replied, "As surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you." So the two of them walked on. 50 men from the company of the prophets went and stood at a distance, facing the place where Elijah and Elisha had stopped at the Jordan. Elijah took his cloak, rolled it up, and struck the water with it. The water divided to the right and to the left, and the two of them crossed over on dry ground. When they had crossed, Elijah said to Elisha, "Tell me, what can I do for you before I am taken from you?" "Let me inherit a double portion of your spirit," Elisha replied. "You have asked a difficult thing," Elijah said. "Yet, if you see me when I am taken from you, it will be yours. Otherwise, it will not." As they were walking along and talking together, suddenly a chariot of fire and horses of fire appeared and separated the two of them, and Elijah went up to heaven in a whirlwind. Elisha saw this and cried out, my father, the chariots and horsemen of Israel." And Elisha saw him no more. Then he took hold of his garment and tore it in two.
Hear these words from Mark. 6 days after a discussion about his identity with his disciples, Jesus led Peter and James and John up a high mountain. They were apart from the others, by themselves. Jesus was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling white, such as no one on earth could bleach them. Elijah and Moses appeared. They were talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus,
"Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us make three dwellings, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah."
Peter did not know what to say, for they were terrified. Then a cloud overshadowed them, and from the cloud there came a voice.
"This is my son, the beloved. Listen to him."
Suddenly, when the disciples looked around, they saw no one with them, only Jesus.
We just heard two Bible stories read aloud for us this morning. Both of them rank pretty high in the fantastical category. They are surreal and strange and glorious. In the second one, Jesus leads Peter, James, and John up a high mountain. The four of them all by themselves up there, up on a high mountaintop where the air is thin and the sky is big. Jesus led these three up there, and it says while up there, Jesus is transfigured. Something happens up there. Jesus' clothes go dazzling white. That was first, but then Elijah and Moses make a guest appearance. Odd. And Elijah and Moses are talking with Jesus. Odd. And there must be some kind of time warp going on because Elijah and Moses had been dead and gone for centuries back there, way back in the distant past. Yes, but yet somehow alive now and talking? It's odd. So here they all are, four to begin with, then six, talking with a dazzling Jesus atop a high mountain, most fantastical and yet glorious. Ever wish you could have been there to be part of all the transfiguration goings on? Ever wish you could step into the matrix, step right into a Bible scene? Would it have been helpful to be there rather than hearing about it, reading about it all these years later? Well, there's more of the same in the Old Testament reading. Things, details that move us into the matrix of another realm, into another dimension, one that we're not used to, maybe. Elijah taken up into heaven in a whirlwind. It's unusual, strange. And is that the way we picture our heaven-bound journey? Swing low, sweet chariot? And another thing, as we have heard, there is in this scripture a whole company of prophets. Maybe we have heard of a prophet, a singular Isaiah, a singular Jeremiah or Amos, a singular modern-day prophet like a Martin Luther King or a Gandhi, even, but there in today's reading, there is a whole posse of them, a collective of prophetic types, a prophetic union. And where exactly would we get in touch with one of those today, a whole huddle of prophets? Strange, very, very strange. And then there is Elijah's mantle that, when used to strike water, the water parts in opposite directions, divides so that you could walk through on the other side. Not once, but twice. Mantle parting power. And I don't know if any one of you have gone and down to the Conococheague lately and tried that out, but it is one of the many unusual features in today's Bible lesson. Fantastic, unbelievable happenings. So there are all of these amazing details to hear from them. It was back in 7th or 8th grade, and I did check this out with Miss Connie, but back in our 7th and 8th grade class in our school, we had a reading class with Mr. Yike. And one day, Mr. Yike had each of us students doing a kind of reading comprehension test. There were different colored boxes of stories that we could choose from, and on the back, they had questions to be answered. The colors went from easy to more difficult, as I remember it. And with our chosen colored materials in hand, we were given the command, on your mark, get set, go, start reading. And we were timed for a couple minutes, and then on a stop command, we had to flip over the reading card and answer the questions about what we had just been reading. It was meant to find the reading speed that was best for our comprehension speed. In high school typing class, word speed was also encouraged. Higher word speeds got us higher grades. Keep the words speeding. Comprehension and retention didn't mean anything in this class. In college, there was an increase in the number of pages that we were required to read, and a speed reading course was offered for teaching techniques for reading more quickly to cover more ground. And lo, when you get to master's work level, there are even more pages to read. And I don't know if such things still exist, but one of the things that happens when we bring our words per minute approach to reading the Bible, we begin to think of the action of what we are reading as moving at a similar pace. We begin to value the number of pages read in a day, the number of chapters we accomplished in a week, making it a goal to read the Bible through 3 times in 1 year. All right. So one of the suggested ways of approaching reading our Bibles is to slow down the pace. Try to capture the pace of the action that is actually going on there. Don't rush it. Give yourself some ponder time. Like, did the Elijah story that we just heard read, however fantastical it might sound, take place in the same 2 minutes it took to read it? Or was it over 2 days, or 2 months, or 2 years, or was it even longer? And if we slow down the action, we might take into account the notice of another character, a different one, other than the hero of the story. Find ourselves paying closer attention to the minor characters, and what do they have going on? In today's reading, Elijah is one of the ones that gets our attention the quickest. He is, after all, the one who possesses mantle-parting power. Spoiler alert, he's also the one whisked into heaven in a chariot. And he is the one who is transported through time warp and is talking with a dazzling Jesus centuries later. Elijah is the hero type. Elijah is the one that gets our attention first. But slow it down. What about the other E guy? The supporting cast? What about Elisha? What are we to think of him? What is his deal? Elisha, there is some backstory to him available. If we back it up in the book of 2 Kings, we learn that Elisha is a young man. We find out that Elijah is the one who spots out young Elisha early on, calls him away from his day job, his oxen plowing farming day job, to a new vocation. New vocation, woo-woo! Now, if we were to soundbite all this, it might sound like it is pacing out rather quickly. But the truth of the matter is about 7 or 8 years go by. Cue the Jeopardy music. Cue the Jeopardy music and play it for 8 years. From the time Elisha makes his appearance until we get to today's scripture lesson, 7 or 8 years go by. And what's going on during those years? You name it, probably. Travel, eating, praying, sleeping, job shadowing, mentoring, complete with a fair amount of do-overs, probably. On-the-ground experiential learning curve, admiration for one's teacher, a relational bond that develops quite deeply over that time, 8 years worth of close connection, warts and all kind of closeness. And maybe what we have to do, maybe it would do us well to think of the deepest relationship that we have developed over a long period of time. Who is that person for you? Why are they so dear? What is the closeness that you share with this person? The one and only you have come to appreciate the most with highest regard. Then bring that understanding into this morning's scripture. And then maybe we begin to have some sympathy for a member of the supporting cast, Elisha, and his protracted and difficult and creaky goodbye with his mentor. In this story, it is the hero Elijah who knows that his departure time is close, and the two of them are on their way to a place called Gilgal. Elijah says to him, "Stay here, I'm going ahead to Bethel." Elisha says, "As the Lord lives, I will not leave you." He's hanging on. He's hanging on. Does that ring any faint bells to anyone? So Elijah concedes and allows him to keep traveling along with him to Bethel. Well, in Bethel, then there's this posse of prophets that come out to greet them, and they give it a go. They say to Elisha, "You know, dude, the time is getting close for you to say goodbye to your master." And Elisha says, I know, but shush yourself. Shush yourself. My version of the Bible is polite at this point. It says, keep silent. But I wonder if that's what was going on. I wonder if it might have been more akin to my nephew Jonathan, who when he was 3 and was riding in a boisterous car of kids towards McDonald's with his older chatterbox sister chattering away and with arguments going on as to which radio station should be tuned. In the middle of it all, Jonathan found his 3-year-old words that he needed. He said, "Silence! I demand silence!" In our story, this happens 3 times. Same sequence, once between Gilgal and Bethel, once in Bethel, once more in Jericho. Same scene, "As the Lord lives, I will not leave you." "Yes, yes, yes, I know he's leaving, but silence." 3 times. And does this sound in any way like Elisha is eager to move on? Does this not show a protracted, squeaky reluctance of departure? Resistance to cross over the threshold from his past of 8 years and into the future, from a safe place into an uncharted territory. It took around 8 years if we read this at the correct pace. There is fantasticalness going on, but there is more. There are chariots of fire and whirlwinds carrying a chariot of fire into the glories of heaven, but there is more. There is a threshold to cross over. And there is a relatable person in this scripture who goes by the name of Elisha, who is careful, who takes his time, who is deliberate, whose reluctance to cross over probably mirrors our own. Can we relate to him? Last Sunday, I made some reference to my ancestors, this lineage that I have of not doing it correctly, is that I call my people, who made their way from Switzerland across the Atlantic to the port of Philadelphia and settled down a little north of that port city, for better or for worse, as things have played out. And have you noticed this year's television commercial advertisement for Valentine's Day? The gift of 23andMe, where instead of the usual dark chocolate or yellow roses, you can do the gift of a DNA search to trace back beyond the stories you know of where your loved ones might have come from. It's funny, not too long ago I learned from my cousin who has done one of these DNA tests, found that our family people were not only in Switzerland, but they were only there for a while. There was a before that. By tracing our DNA thread, she found that our gene pool, our family gene pool, is Celtic, half of it. That is, my people did not originate where I thought, but at some point further back, they had lived, had come from further west, I don't know, maybe Ireland or England or Greenland, had picked up and moved east and settled in Switzerland at some point. And have you ever thought about where your ancestors came from? And more pressing to the question is, have you ever wondered why they moved? What is it that causes a major move? What was the threshold moment for them? We who are generations of settled can imagine what events took place, what caused our ancestral people to say one day, we must go now. We must not look back any longer, we have to move. Remember the Lot and his wife story from Genesis? How when they were moving out of the city of Sodom, Lot's wife kept looking back there, back to where things were familiar. Life in the rearview mirror, and she longed to go back there and stay. And her life came to a standstill because of it. Lot crossed the threshold. His wife stayed back and solidified. If you are one who follows such things, then you know that today is, as Connie mentioned, Transfiguration Sunday. It's an annual day that comes around on the church calendar. Coming up this week, just after today, is Fat Tuesday, and some of us will be sauntering off to the country breeze to get us some Fasnacht. And then will come Ash Wednesday, and then after that comes a full 40 days of Lent, a longer haul, a slower pace. It is appropriate on this day, this Sunday, for us to follow the story of Jesus going up on a high mountain. There is glory going on up there, and there is much strange, and there is much that is odd. But there are also bit players in this drama as well. They go by the names of Peter, James, and John, but really, they could be any one of us. For there they are, trying, kicking and screaming, as it were, trying to cross over a threshold. Suggesting tents, suggesting to Jesus that they stay put and bask in the glory. And ain't that just the way of it? More than we care to admit, we're more likely to end up alongside Pete and company, wanting to pitch our tents and stay put, reluctant to let Jesus take the lead in going forward to unknown places. And Transfiguration Sunday, along with these two scriptures that are suggested, are not meant to pile up a load of guilt just before Lent begins. Peter, James, and John are not on Transfiguration Mountain, racked with the guilt of their sins, seeking out a confessional booth. No, that is not it. They are there because Jesus has invited them. And the three of them are up there in a threshold moment, with Jesus' words about death and resurrection still hot on his lips, and not understanding any of their future that is ready to unfold on the backside of this mountain. And ain't that just the way it often goes in our lives? These two Bible stories we heard this morning are not meant to ramp up our pre-Lent guilt. No. Instead, they are meant to suggest that the day that we decide to follow Jesus, we cross over a threshold and leave some things behind and move into a future that is unknown, and that it is glory that draws us into that future.